Hey guys, welcome to the Ardella Training Podcast. This is your host, Scott Ardella, and this is episode number 199, which means we are one show away from episode number 200. Now, this week's show is another phenomenal guest with the awesome Juliet Starrett. Juliet is the CEO of MobilityWOD along with her husband, Kelly. She is the co-founder of San Francisco CrossFit and co-author of the incredible book, Deskbound. She is amazing, and I've been fortunate to have quite a bit of communication with her, and she is truly one of the nicest people I've ever been in contact with, and I'm super excited to have her here on the show for this week's episode. Now, this week's interview is fast and furious, and what I mean is it's a rapid-fire session loaded with great content. We covered a lot of different topics in this session. And Juliet has great energy and passion. She's really a ball of energy. And I really had fun doing this interview session. We discussed her background and evolution as an athlete, some of her recent experiences with Gabby Reese, Laird Hamilton, and Brian McKenzie. As a matter of fact, you're going to hear about that as we open up the interview session. She discusses how she approaches fitness with her kids. And this is great advice, especially if you're a parent. And Juliet shares her daily readiness assessment, which is simple and a great thing that we can all put into practice. Now, we discuss these things and so much more. Again, many different topics in this jam-packed interview session. And again, we covered a lot of ground, and she shares great information in a very fun and engaging interview session. Now, before we get into the interview, I'm working on a special episode for episode number 200 next week. So stay tuned for that great show where I will take you a little bit behind the scenes and tell you about all the work that is involved in doing these podcasts, and then do something different where I'm going to kind of look back at 200 episodes and all the great guests and things that we've talked about here on this podcast. So stay tuned for that. And last week's show with Katie Bowman was really incredible. We had huge downloads for that show and really fantastic feedback from that episode in particular with biomechanist and author Katie Bowman. So if you haven't heard that episode, I'd highly recommend checking that one out. And if you have heard it, thank you so much for making that episode such a huge success. Lastly, for easy access to this show, the show notes and all the resources that we discussed in this session, you can find this episode at ardellatraining.com/RT199. You'll also find the link to the new community page at Ardella Training, and again, all of the great resources that we discuss in this episode by going to ardellatraining.com/RT199. All right, guys, with that, let's jump into the interview this week, and I really hope you enjoy this week's session as much as I did. I can't tell you how excited I am to have Juliet Starrett join the show actually as a return guest. But this time we're going to find out more about Juliet, and I think this will be an awesome session. As I just mentioned, I'm really excited about it. Juliet Starrett is a lifelong athlete, co-founder of San Francisco CrossFit, co-author of the amazing book Deskbound, and of course, co-founder of MobilityWOD. First of all, Juliet, I wanted to just say thank you for Deskbound, because I think that is probably one of the most significant books in human performance. And I really, really mean that. And it had a major effect on me personally. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to post a picture in the show notes for this episode and show you exactly what I mean. So I'm not going to tell you about it, but there's going to be a visual in the show notes for the episode. So you're going to have to check that out. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. And I also am looking forward to seeing the photo that you post in the show notes.
Absolutely. So listen, I've got a ton of questions for you here, and we're going to just jump right into things.
Great.
So the big thing is, I saw some pictures of you in Instagram, or on Instagram, I should say. You're just back from the XPT Life experience where you and Kelly are advisors. So let's start with that. Tell us about that experience.
Sure. XPT, for those who have never heard of it, actually stands for Extreme Pool Training. And it is sort of a training method developed by Laird Hamilton, Gabby Reese, and Brian McKenzie. And It's actually really a lifestyle. They call it the XPT experience because it's really, I would describe it as like a lifestyle seminar. During the seminar, you spend most of the time working on breathing, ice and heat transitions. You do some pool training, beach training, sort of brings in the concept of taking personal risk a little bit. So I know in the future they're going to be adding in some additional sort of adventure type components to it as well. But it is just plain fun. And Kelly and I love participating in it and being around it. And we learn so much. And it is also really awesome for us to be able to go to Kauai in the middle of this terrible winter we're having here in Northern California.
Oh, wow.
So it was a blast.
Nice. So with the ice training. It's funny because we've been talking about this in the past couple of podcast episodes. Actually, I had Scott Carney on, who wrote a book called "What Doesn't Kill Us" and the book on environmental conditioning. Amazing read, by the way. But I saw a picture of you, Tim Ferriss, Amelia Boone sitting in an ice tub. Gabby Reese appears to be laughing hysterically. What was going through your mind in that picture?
Well, I'll start by saying that was the greatest ice bath I've ever taken. I am a fan and a believer in this sort of ice and heat transition that these guys have brought into my life. But I will tell you that the ice baths are really hard for me. I'm someone who runs naturally very cold all the time. I am, wearing a puffy coat as I'm taking this interview. And so it has been a serious challenge for me to sort of work up to even be able to sit in the ice bath for 2 minutes. So I'll say that was the greatest ice bath I've ever taken, because I don't even know what we were laughing and joking around about, but just the fact of it, helped me survive almost 2.5 minutes in there, which for me is a really long time.
Wow.
It was really fun.
So are you doing this as part of your kind of daily or weekly practices when you're at home?
We do. Kelly and I started off, it was funny, Kelly came home one day and he said, okay, we're going to ice bath. And he had this whole plan where he was going to go out and, buy like a $2,000 ice machine and this fancy ice bath. And I said, wait, let's like cool our brakes a little bit. Let's see if we can find some other little strategy where we can incorporate this into our life and actually see if we continue doing it. So we bought a little like tall, I would describe it as like a tall rubber kiddie pool that just fits one person, and a small little refrigerator that we plugged in outdoors. And we started making ice blocks and filling up this little tub with water and ice blocks. So not the little ice chips you see in that photo with Tim and I.
Right.
And we just started doing it. We don't have a sauna. When you go to XPT Experience, you transition between ice bathing and a sauna, but we do have a hot tub. So we started doing ice bath, hot tub. And I have to say that I was a massive skeptic about it in the beginning, and largely because I am, again, I'm always freezing, so I couldn't really see a benefit.
Right.
But there's been, I've noticed some really important things, including my ability to tolerate cold better, and just my general feeling of cold has gone down. So that's been sort of an interesting phenomenon for me. And then because we saw that we fit it into our life, it made us feel great. And we were doing it on a regular basis. I actually got Kelly what I call a bespoke ice tub for his birthday last fall. I'm not sure if you saw that on Instagram, but it's this beautiful two-person metal ice tub that we now have that has replaced the $75 rubber kiddie pool we got on Amazon.
Nice. So you've definitely experienced some benefit with this.
Yes. I understand the benefit from Laird and Gabby and Brian and Wim Hof and others who are proponents of this to be, nervous system recovery. I'll say that I feel like we usually ice in the morning, by the way. That's sort of part of our morning routine. And I just find it generally invigorating, like it's the sort of the equivalent of having 2 cups of coffee for me. And I just feel good when I do this ice heat transition. And we really do try to fit it into our crazy busy lives. I think ideally when you're at XPT, you do 3 minutes in the ice and 15 minutes in sauna and back and forth. And Kelly and I don't have time to do that on the regular basis. We will do that more on weekends. But we, in the mornings on weekdays before we go to work, we're 10 minutes in the hot tub, 1 minute in the ice bath, or 2 minutes in the ice bath, 5 minutes in the hot tub, and then we're off to work. and we just feel great.
Yeah. You know, I recently, again, just spoke about this in a podcast as well, and I'm not taking it to the level that you guys are. All I'm doing is cold showers in the morning. You know,
yes.
I start hot and then I go cold to finish up, and it is incredibly invigorating, as you just said. So just doing that. And the other thing, I mean, honestly, I live here in South Florida, Juliet, and, you know, we've had a couple of cold days, cold for us, you know, it's relative, you know,
right,
compared to where we are, but the pool gets cool. And now what I'm doing is getting in the pool when it gets cold. And again, it just feels great. And I feel like I am kind of building up this conditioning to the cooler temperatures. Yeah.
I would completely agree. We actually do the same thing in the winter. You know, we're lucky enough to have a pool in our backyard. So we actually have not been doing the ice bath this winter because our pool is all the way down at like 39 degrees. We obviously don't heat it in the winter. So we can get, you know, basically the same effect by just sitting in our pool for 3 minutes and then jumping right back into the hot tub. So we're totally on the same tip as you, doing the exact same thing.
Nice.
It works great. And, you know, Laird and Gabby and Brian actually are huge proponents of the cold shower. I mean, you know, they of course understand that everybody cannot, you know, set up an ice bath in their backyard and get a sauna, and, you know, that these are sort of complex things, but that there really is simple ways to get the benefits of this. And that's by, you know, taking even just adding on a really cold shower at the end of your shower in the morning.
Nice. Just a couple more quick questions about the XPT life experience, but are you guys involved in all of the events that are going on? I see that there's quite a few coming up.
You know, we attend what we can. We have a total blast going to these events, and the people who attend, you know, I think it's been just as valuable for Kelly and I as advisors and instructors to go. We learn so much from the people who attend as we feel like we teach going into them. So we can't do them all, unfortunately, but we will probably continue to do two or three of them a year as we can based on our schedule.
Got it. And last question is, who should consider attending something like this?
You know, I think anyone who has already been sort of tinkering with their health and fitness, but really wants to and appreciates the need to add in more of a down regulation practice into their life. And I certainly fall into that category. You know, I'm kind of a go, 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 go person. And I think anyone who's sort of figured out, you know, roughly figured out their nutrition and their training in life, but realizes that, you know, as a species, we've done a really good job winding ourselves up, and a really terrible job figuring out how to wind ourselves down. And I probably didn't do the best job explaining at the beginning. I mean, I think in the end, you know, the huge takeaways from XPT are sort of how to downregulate, how to bring yourself down. And so I think anyone who has, you know, a crazy busy job or life, or is a sort of an, you know, person who's on all the time, I think these are strategies you can really bring into your life to sort of, you know, standardize and figure out how to just, you know, bring yourself down a few notches and really rest and recover.
Nice. I'll make sure to put a link to this in the show notes for the episode. One last question actually is, how many people attend these events? These are pretty small groups.
You know, it's anywhere between 15 and 20 people, okay, based on the ones I've been to. So it feels intimate. You really get to know the other attendees. You know, we all stay in touch afterwards. So it has been, you know, I think the group size is great because, you know, you socially get to know people, you heat nice and spend time, you know, in the sauna, getting to know where people are coming from. And so I think the, you know, 15 to 20 people is perfect size.
Nice. All right, let's move on to some training questions, and that was something I really wanted to ask you about. I know you have an incredible background as an athlete. Actually, if you could, just briefly kind of talk about your background as an athlete, but my question is going to be, how do you train today? How have things changed for you?
Sure. You know, I would say I started my formal athletic background when I was 15 years old, a sophomore in high school, and I joined the rowing team at my local high school. And I was in Southern California, and at least at that time, which was the late 80s, there weren't a ton of high school rowing programs on the West Coast. Of course, it's been around forever on the East Coast, but I was part of sort of an emerging trend of, you know, younger kids going into rowing. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, I was sporty and played on a bunch of teams up until that point, but that was really the first time I sort of fell in love with something, which I think is funny in retrospect because it's just such a suffer sport. So I'm not sure how one really falls in love with it, but I did. I fell in love with it, and I rode all through high school. My team won the California State Championship when I was a senior in high school, so that was very exciting. And then I went on to row at UC Berkeley, where I went to college. And that was also in the dawn of time as well. You know, we actually had to threaten a Title IX suit against the university because the California men's crew team at the time was one of the largest endowed college teams in the whole country because some very noteworthy people had, you know, been part of the rowing program throughout the years, the men's rowing team. And so, you know, we did some fighting to get let into the beautiful men's boathouse, and I was part of all of that. And so I rode for a couple of years at UC Berkeley, and then I decided to play more and have more fun because being a college athlete was amazing, but about a 25-hour a week commitment in terms of training. So I played ultimate frisbee, and throughout this period of time, I became a river rafting guide, which I will talk about more later, I suspect, as we talk about the business side of my life. But I became a river rafting guide, and so I had this sort of background of, you know, competitive rowing and like pulling hard on a paddle type item. And so I was invited in 1997 to try out for the U.S. women's extreme whitewater team. And this is describe it to your viewers, this is a totally fringe sport, probably something that you would see like in an X Games type environment. And yeah. Nice. Anyway, so it's whitewater rafting, and I participated on the team for 5 years from 1997 through 2000, won 5 national championships, 2 world championships. And just to backtrack on the sport, it's super small in the United States, but actually huge in places like Europe and New Zealand and Australia. In those places, they actually, the athletes can make a living doing that sport. Wow. So I have no idea whether it'll ever take on in the U.S., but for me, it was a blast because I got to travel all over the world. You know, my world championship events were on the Zambezi River in Africa, in Zimbabwe, on the Orange River in South Africa, in Costa Rica, and then South America, where Kelly and I actually met.
Wow.
I can't talk about my training today without talking about sort of this void period that Kelly and I had. You know, we both retired from training in 2000, and that's also the same year that I started law school. Okay. And Kelly and I were together living in San Francisco, and we both had this like lifelong history at this point of training all the time, and we continued to do that, but we lacked inspiration. We belonged to this sort of fitness club in San Francisco called Club One, and we would sort of go in and like lift some weights and do the Stairmaster, and you know, we just really had no inspiration. We knew that we wanted to keep training and, you know, working towards that. And of course we would bike and mountain bike and do a lot of outdoor sports as well, but we lacked inspiration. And in 2003, we discovered CrossFit and fell in love with it because we thought we were totally awesome athletes. And then we started doing some CrossFit workouts and got ourselves just crushed.
Yeah.
And realized that we were weak and slow and had no skills. So, so that sort of began our, you know, journey in this CrossFit world. And you know, it's now almost 13 years we've owned a CrossFit gym and have been, you know, doing CrossFit. I will say that my training over those years has really been up and down. You know, I competed in the CrossFit Games in 2010 on a team. So I've had some phases in there where I am intensely CrossFitting, you know,
right,
once, twice a day, 6 days a week. I went through a phase 2 years ago where I was like, I cannot touch a barbell. I'm super bored of touching barbells.
Really?
So wow. I didn't touch a barbell for 6 months.
Okay.
And I did more endurance programming.
Yeah.
Today, I am actually following a program created by Aaron Cafaro, going back to my roots as an athlete. And for those of your viewers who don't know, Aaron Cafaro is married to Brian McKenzie, whom I was speaking about earlier, and is a 2-time Olympic gold medalist in rowing. And she invited me to participate in the fall in a 10-week program, which I am in the midst of now, called the Winter Row 2K program, which is basically a, we receive 6 days a week of programming, and the ultimate goal is rowing a 2,000-meter test on the rowing machine, which is sort of the holy grail of rowing. And so I'm at week 8 of 10 weeks on that. So in 2 weeks, I'll be doing my 2K erg test. And it's an interesting program. It's a lot of rowing, but it's a lot of, you know, sort of functional training, CrossFit type workouts on the off days. So it's 3 days a week of sort of a functional training workout and 3 days a week of an intense rowing piece. So that's what I'm doing today. So, and I have 2 more weeks until my erg test.
Yeah. Great story. Amazing story and journey line there. So it sounds like conditioning endurance is a primary focus for now, and then some strength work is incorporated into this as well?
There definitely is. I mean, you know, I'm usually 1 day a week squatting or front squatting, deadlifting. You know, there's definitely strength training looped into all this program I'm doing.
Got it. Now, do you train with Kelly, or how do you guys work that?
We do, and we like to joke around that we're our favorite training partners, and I know a lot of married couples don't train well together, but we actually do. We don't fight. We get along. Yeah. You know, Kelly likes to sort of, you know, he can't help himself, so he has to coach me if he sees, you know, that I have bad technique. But I don't mind, and we actually love training together. So, you know, it's at, we just said the other day, I've been doing this program, so this is sort of the first time in a long time that I've been sort of doing my own thing because I'm following this set program and he's not doing it. But one of the things I miss while I'm doing this program is training with him.
Nice. Well, you're right. I mean, it is hard to train with your spouse. I've tried it a couple of times. It just really hasn't worked out.
I think we're kind of an outlier in that way. I think we have sort of similar, you know, we like to do the same things for training. So that helps a lot. You know, it, I think, you know, we often go through different little phases of things we're training for, but basically we're always doing the same things and that works well. So we've worked it out.
Definitely. Now, what about the kids? How do you bring the girls into it?
You know, our strategy with the kids is to try to show them that, you know, training and exercising is just a normal part of life. It's not like a maybe sort of thing that, you know, we try to show them. We have a gym in our garage, as you may have seen in some form or fashion in a Mobility Wad video or otherwise.
Right.
But we have a full gym in our garage, which we've been, you know, growing over the years and adding new pieces to. And a lot of it, I'll tell you, is filled with like rejected equipment from our regular gym. So, you know, most of our barbells are bent and our weight plates are cracked, and you know it's certainly not fancy by any stretch of the imagination, but our kids see that we train as part of our life, and it's not a choice for us. For us, it's like we do this and this is what we do as a family. So, you know, our hope is that by seeing that, that they will sort of adopt the same strategy. Our older daughter Georgia actually trains with us now a couple times a week, which is really fun. Nice. You know, she can clean and jerk and snatch and, you know, do little metabolic conditioning workouts with us. And, you know, just as a parent, that is the best. You know, I do worry that, you know, they're going to decide that they don't ever want to exercise again based on who their parents are. But, you know, all we can do is sort of set the stage and just say, look, you know, we try to eat well and train hard and take care of our bodies. And we're hoping that that just sort of, you know, passes along to them. And they're sporty and outdoorsy and athletic. So, you know, I'm not super worried.
So it's kind of that role modeling effect, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We're hoping that they see what we do. And of course we hang out, you know, most of our friends sort of have a similar lifestyle to us. So we're hoping that they just see that, you know, this is how we create a healthy body and healthy mind, and they'll adopt it in their own lives.
Yeah. You know, I've said this so many times on the show, but you know, that's a big reason why I train. Well, obviously I love training, but you know, I train at home. I have a garage gym, and I do that with the idea that, you know, my girls will see me training, and what happens is they'll venture out into the garage and they'll end up sometimes, you know, joining me for a session and things like that. I don't try to, you know, put it in their face or anything like that, but it's kind of that role modeling thing. You know, the two things I'm really passionate about are training and reading. And those are the things that I always want my girls to see me doing. and hopefully they'll learn to love those things as well. You can't force it, you know?
Yeah. But, we have the exact same philosophy. I mean, we are always worried and conscious about, you know, trying to, you know, obviously this is what Kelly and I have fallen in love with, and we don't want to force that upon them. But we also think, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a violinist or a graphic designer or an architect or, you know, are in the fitness business, you know, training and taking care of yourself is mandatory.
Yeah.
But, you know, interesting story about that. I'll tell you that our daughter, Georgia, who's 11, has been really into volleyball for the last few years. She plays in a club team, which Kelly and I had some reservations about, but it's been great for her and driven by her. But I had to point out to Kelly last year, I said, hey, you know, I appreciate that you are trying so hard not to be like that dad, you know, like who coaches or, you know, says things from the sidelines. But I said, but, you know, you are Kelly Starrett, and our daughter should at least like enjoy some of the benefits of her, you know, she being the daughter of you. And so, you know, he's really just trying to strike that balance. You know, he doesn't want to be the overbearing parent on the sidelines, you know, yelling at his kid to do this or do that. You know, he really wants to give the coaches a chance to coach the kids and be professionals. But also, you know, giving some little tidbits on the side. So he's working out that balance, but it was funny because I was like, hey, you know, like you've never actually said one thing to our daughter because you're trying so hard to be cool.
Right.
So it's a challenge, but we're trying to, you know, figure out what the balance is.
And once again, how old is Georgia?
Georgia is 11. And then our younger daughter, Caroline, is 8.
Okay. So when did she start? You said she does snatches and clean and jerks.
So she has been deadlifting and front squatting for years, probably starting when she was 7 or 8 years old. And, you know, I'll tell you, this is with a little kids bar and, you know, lightweights,
yeah,
if
sure,
any.
Sure.
But just last year, she got some Olympic lifting shoes, and this was at her request. She one of the items on her Christmas list was Olympic lifting shoes. So of course, Kelly and I were delighted. And so she got some Olympic lifting shoes. So she started doing some of the Olympic movements, you know, again, with like a 10 or 15 pound kids bar, usually unweighted, just to sort of grease those patterns and learn the movements. So it's been fun to see her do that.
Nice. And so let me ask you this, what advice would you have for people that are listening, maybe even coaches and trainers that are starting to work with youth and kids and their own kids? What advice do you have to encourage exercise, but not make it something, not push it in an overly aggressive way?
You know, I think it is exactly what you and I have already talked about, which is modeling.
Yeah.
Because I think any push is always going to result in a pushback. And, you know, if the goal is really to, you know, our goal, Kelly and I will start by saying, could care less if our kids are professional athletes. We want our kids to feel good about their bodies and be healthy and want to take care of their bodies throughout their life. And so that's, you know, I think starting with that is the goal. And I do think a lot of parents in this day and age have sort of, you know, gone down this path where they think their kid is going to be, you know, definitely get a college scholarship and become a professional athlete. And I think that's misguided and does put a lot of pressure on kids. So our strategy has been to model healthy behavior, you know, in training and eating and playing, and hope that our kids learn it that way. What I will say is it's been very interesting for us to be in this club sport environment, because I see how easy it is to have your kid specialize in a sport. I mean, you and I, I'm sure, have both read 100 articles, you know, about how over-specialization is terrible for kids. And then it's been very interesting for us to be on the parent side of it.
Yeah.
And see how, you know, the volleyball season for us starts in December. It basically ends at the beginning of May, the tournaments, but then our club also does a beach volleyball program. So they switch into beach volleyball and they play beach volleyball in June, May and June. But then of course the club offers summer camps. So you can put your kid in summer camps the whole summer. And then before tryouts in November, there's all these clinics. So you could easily, without a breath, we could easily have our kid in year-round volleyball, and that's it. And I see now that I'm on the, you know, the parent side of having a kid in a club sport, I see how easy it is. And I got some really good advice, and And that was that if you've got a kid in club sport, regardless of what it is, that it's your job as a parent to make sure for 2 to 3 months of every year, they do not do that sport at all. So, you know, our goal with Georgia is to say, hey, look, there's going to be 2 or 3 months of your year where there you do not touch a volleyball. And that's not to say that she's not going to be active. Of course, she's going to ride her bike and play and train with us and continue to be an active person. But that it's got to be actually on the parent to cut it off. Otherwise, that's the cycle. You know, it's the over-specialization, the injuries, the burnout, you name it. Sure. You know, there's nobody that thinks that specializing in a sport at 12 years old is a good idea. But I also am a business owner and I see what the athletic clubs are up against. And basically they need to have year-round revenue. So for a club, for a club to survive, they need to have camps and clinics and things and whatever. They can't just have a seasonal sport. Otherwise the club doesn't survive. So, you know, I think it's attendant upon the parents and not, it can't be upon the club or the coaches or whatever to say, hey, you need to pull your kid out for 2 months. Parents just have to draw the line and say, you know what? My kid is, it's not going to change their sport trajectory if they're not playing the sport for 2 out of 12 months of a year.
That's great advice. Great advice. Love it. So we're talking about kids. So along those lines, give us a quick update on Stand Up Kids and what's happening there, because that actually was the basis of our previous podcast session. So give us a quick update on the great things that are happening.
Sure. Well, as you know from our last podcast, we were invited to be part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, which does have guaranteed funding for the next 3 years. So the program will continue on, even though the Obamas are no longer in the White House. But we, as part of that program, we agreed to give out $50,000 a year in standing desk grants, and we are going to focus on high poverty schools. So we actually just closed, put out our grant application on January 15th, and last night at midnight was the last day to submit applications. And we actually only have enough funds to give out 10 grants to teachers. And we got 250 applications, which is, of course, very validating for a cause, because we've known all along that teachers are sort of dying for new solutions in the classroom. So even though we aren't going to be able to fund all those classrooms, it gives us more motivation to continue to raise money and, you know, keep the cause going. So by April 1st, we will be delighted to announce our grant winners and be giving out, you know, there'll be another 200 or 300 kids standing in classrooms across the country, mostly in high poverty schools. So that's kind of what we've been working on now, and we're super excited about. And, you know, as an organization, we think we probably have 35,000 kids standing nationwide as of now. And that's not including all the schools that are converting to standing desks, you know, without any association to Stand Up Kids. I know a lot of private schools are doing it, and, you know, other schools are just, you know, going out on their own and getting standing desks. So there's definitely something to this. The momentum keeps rolling. You know, Kelly and I are in this for the long game. We're just slowly trying to make connections and raise money and sort of, you know, meet the needs of teachers who are requesting standing desks. So it's going great, and we are excited.
The easiest, best way for people to get involved?
The easiest, best way is to check out our website. It's standupkids.org. There is a ton of information. And, you know, one of the questions we get a lot is from parents who want to implement it in their school. And my advice to those parents is, you know, become a mini expert on why standing desks, and then find a champion in your school. You know, what we've learned is it's not hard. We have found so many teachers and administrators who are seeking alternative solutions. You know, these are the people that are on the ground with kids fidgeting and not getting enough physical activity in their day. And so they are really looking and open to new possibilities. So our recommendation is find a teacher or a principal or administrator at a school who is excited about the idea, and just flip one classroom.
Nice.
Because once that's done and people see that it's not weird and the kids don't get too tired and it, you know, that it's actually wonderful, you know, it just, that starts the trickle effect throughout a whole school.
I like what you just said about becoming a mini expert on why this is important. And there's so much great information on the website on standupkids.org. So, great advice there.
Thanks.
All right. So shifting gears again, The question is, from your perspective, what's the biggest problem in the fitness industry?
Geez, I mean, I really look at it from a business owner side, and I think what I'm seeing as a problem right now is this huge growth of what I would call boutique fitness, and I would include CrossFit in that. I mean, I don't think that CrossFit would love to be included as a boutique fitness, but I have seen a huge explosion in sort of boutique gyms, whatever they are, whether it's CrossFit or SoulCycle or Orange Theory or, you know, you name it, they're everywhere. And I think that the market maybe is already saturated with that. And so what I see within my own even personal gym membership is people are like, oh my God, exciting Orange Theory, I'm going to try that. And then they do Orange Theory for a few weeks, and then they go to SoulCycle, and then they're back at CrossFit. And yeah. I think that there is so much noise in the space just in terms of options for people. They aren't sure what to do anymore. You know, I think I think getting away from the Globo gym was a wonderful change. You know, I think people were bored and lonely, and it wasn't fun to go work out at a big Globo gym. But I also think, you know, I worry that all these training facilities, basically one per block, is not sustainable for the industry as a whole.
So how do you recommend what you just said about sorting through options? There is a lot of noise out there. There's a lot of distractions and new shiny new toys and exercise and training. How do you recommend people sort through that?
You know, I think people, I like to sort of categorize things as like high suffer, low skill. Well, I see it as like a spectrum. You know, a Globo gym is like a low touch, no skill environment. And then you go to the complete 180 degree opposite where you would find a CrossFit gym, which is high touch, high skill. And then somewhere in the middle, I would categorize like Orange Theory and SoulCycle and, you know, some of those things that are not really any coaching and sort of high metabolic demand. You know, you go in there and you just like suffer your tail off, but there's not that much skill or coaching involved. So I think obviously all of these things offer something for anyone, and I do try to be training agnostic. I mean, my goal for people is to train, and what they do, I care less about. But I do think there's a lot of no skill, no coaching things that have come into the sphere. You know, SoulCycle's great. I've done SoulCycle. I had a great time. You know, I love the music. It was exciting. I suffered. But it's a low skill, no skill environment and no coaching. You know, and I do think that I hope and I want people to care about learning new skills and, you know, being coached on their technique and movement and mechanics, because I think without that, you know, we're seeing overuse injuries and a whole host of other issues from, you know, just, you know, going into high gear and suffer, 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 suffer. And then that's the only thing you do. So, you know, I think a mix is really the ideal. You know, I understand if people don't want to CrossFit 6 days a week, but I think if you get some high touch training where you're being coached and it's high skill and you're learning new skills and learning new movements, and then you mix that in with some like straight up suffering, like a SoulCycle class, I think that's great. But, you know, I would object to someone soul cycling 6 days a week.
Yeah. So with that, would you say that skill development is at the core of long-term training?
Yes, I completely agree with that, and that's the perfect way to put it. You know, we love CrossFit, and that's sort of the basis of how we train. But really, you know, we always want to keep an eye on what our goal here is. You know, Kelly and I are no longer professional athletes. We're not getting paid to train. You know, our goal is to keep our bodies functional so that we can live and be healthy until we're 100 years old. And so I think skill acquisition is a huge part of it. And I also think that's actually a huge part of keeping your brain active and alive.
Yes.
You know, I think we sort of lost sight of being scared and taking risks and learning new things. And that can easily happen in a very controlled environment that is the gym, where you're learning, you know, a new skill you've never done before. So it's, you know, it's low risk, but it's high skill. And I think there's something to be said for how that develops your brain and keeps your brain active as well.
Yeah, you know, Kelly said in one of the interviews something along the lines, at some point you're not going to be the strongest, but you can always work to be the most skilled mover. And I was like, wow. I mean, because that's what I've been kind of striving for the last 10 years. And it was only in the last 10 years I kind of figured out some things. And I'm kind of going down this path now. But it's, you know, you can, skill development is endless, right? I mean, you can just keep going down that path and refining your skills and techniques.
I completely agree with you. And also new skill learning and acquisition keeps you interested. You know, yeah. I mean, we are all prone to getting bored with whatever training regime it is, but we're less likely to do that if we're learning new skills. And I think that's part of the reason the CrossFit environment has been so interesting for me. I mean, you know, I look at my 30-year, I was 30 years old when I discovered CrossFit. I'd already been a two-time world champion, a five-year professional athlete, a Division I rower. You know, I had this huge athletic background, and I was like, no skill. All I could do was like suffer and pull really hard on an oar or a paddle. Like I was like a zero skill athlete. And so for me, it has been, my learning curve has been gigantic. And, you know, I only wish that I had, you know, started training like this when I was younger because I could have been more awesome.
Yeah, right. Oh man. All right. So with Mobility WOD, what, there's a lot of things going on, it looks like, at Mobility WOD. What's new right now and where are things headed in the future?
Well, one of the things that's new that I know you've seen is we converted our videos into a follow-along format. And it is not just Kelly, but it is me and another woman, Margaret, in all the videos. And, you know, we'd been getting requests and considering shifting to that format for a couple of years, but we sort of reached a point where we realized that, you know, people really wanted to just turn on the TV and follow along with what we were doing. And that's been really successful and really fun. And I think it's also been helpful because Margaret and I are like the tightest people on earth. And, you know, my mobility is something I've been working on for 10 years, and I will literally be working on it until the day I die because, you know, I came out of the womb already stiff, and then I did nothing to take care of myself until I was 32 years old. So for me, it's been an ongoing process, but I think it's been fun for people to see us on the video because Kelly is like a genetic freak of mobility. So it's been fun for people to see some normal people trying to do these things and take care of our bodies and see how, you know, we suffer and work through it. And so that's been a really fun thing, and it's just been a great way to sort of, you know, get our workout to more people. So we've really enjoyed that. We are always continuing to add courses to our course library. So we just launched our 2-day level 2 course, which we've been literally working on for 2 years. And we're very excited about this because what we've seen in the industry is that the coach is often the first person to learn of like basic aches and pains in their athletes. You know, there's sort of this continuum where it's like you're either not hurt or you're hurt. And if you're really hurt, you obviously go to a doctor or a physical therapist. But in between that, you know, 90% of the athletes at our gym are dealing with like a tweak or an ache or a pain or, you know, some kind of little issue they're dealing with in their body. And our goal with this course is to try to teach coaches how to address those sort of basic issues they're seeing in their athletes, you know, whether it's like a little knee tweak or an ankle tweak or their elbow isn't working quite right. So we're obviously not teaching people how to be physical therapists or chiropractors, but we're saying, hey, look, you know, the coach is usually and can and should be sort of the first line of intervention for just these little basic aches and pains and tweaks that athletes are seeing in a gym. And so our goal with this course is to teach coaches some tools and strategies and tips to be able to say, you know, if you have an athlete come up and say, yeah, my knee's just feeling a little tweaky today, that you can do some assessments and get them on a plan to sort of, you know, fix and recover from that before they get to the point of a catastrophic injury where they have to go see a physical therapist or a coach. So we're just rolling that out around the country, and we're really excited about that.
Nice. Now, is this something that Kelly is teaching?
Kelly will be teaching some. We also have an awesome staff of coaches who will be teaching around the country as well, all of whom are physical therapists or chiropractors. So they are a mighty crew of really thoughtful, really wonderful people. So, you know, if folks can't make it to a course Kelly's teaching, they should fear not because they will get a wonderful experience with any of our staff.
Nice. I'm just curious, where do you recommend people that, and I know probably everybody listening to this has been to mobilitywod.com, but people that when they first go to the website, where do you recommend people start? Because there's so much great stuff here.
It's a lot. I think it is overwhelming for people. And Kelly certainly does have like a almost his own special language he uses, which takes people a while to sort of get up to speed on.
Yeah.
But we actually created a series of on-ramp videos recently in the last 6 months for this exact reason. There's five or six videos where Kelly talks a little bit about the lexicon and the language and some of the, positions and sort of what to expect. And that's when I think the feedback on that has been great for new people coming to the site, just to get a sense of, you know, who is this guy and what's he talking about? And when he says, you know, internal or external rotation, what does that mean? And how do I, you know, how do I understand that and, you know, execute that when I'm doing a mobilization? And what even is a mobilization?
Right.
So we've been trying to sort of, we've heard the feedback and realized that it's very hard for folks sometimes to just plop right in and press play on our daily video without having some background information. So that's been something we've added. So I think, you know, for someone new going to the site, we actually have a little section that says get started, and it has those on-ramp videos right there. And that would be where I would send any new person who hasn't been there.
Yeah, and I see that right now. So if you go to the programming tab, and then it says new subscribers start here, and then there you go. You have the on-ramp videos. So awesome.
Exactly.
So you've been called a killer businesswoman and the nicest person in the world. How do you explain that?
Jeez. Well, you know, here's what I'll say. I will say that it has been, and I feel embarrassed when I hear that, by the way, but, you know, I did start into this fitness business with what I think is a bit of an advantage. And that is that I practice as a corporate lawyer in a big, huge international law firm for 7.5 years before I dove headfirst into the fitness industry. So I was already working with and consulting with clients, you know, running, you know, multi-million dollar corporations before I was a business owner myself. And I think that gave me, you know, an interesting and really helpful perspective and way to organize myself. I also came from the corporate world where I learned, I'm not sure how else to describe this, but to be a pro, you know, I can write an email in the English language with a salutation and, you know, and it sounds silly, but it's these basic things that I learned from having a sort of regular job before I dove headfirst into the fitness business. Where I was, you know, at my big law firm, there was high stakes, it was high pressure. And so I learned how to operate in that world. And so I think that that gave me, that background gave me sort of an initial advantage over many others who jump right into the fitness business just because they have a passion for fitness. And then, you know, I am not afraid of working really hard, and I care a lot about what we're doing and, you know, where we're going. And so I think that has helped. And then, you know, I don't know about the nicest person in the world. I mean, I do have a pretty hands-off, you know, my management strategy is, you know, I want and encourage everybody who works for me to kick ass and, of course, ask questions as needed, but I want people to be independent and succeed, and I don't need to micromanage or overmanage people, so that's been my management strategy, and, you know, it so far has worked, and, you know, I'm going to keep going in this path, but, you know, I will tell you that despite my, you know, corporate law background, I have had a huge learning curve as a business owner, and I continue always learning and reading like you. I love to read. So I'm always reading and tinkering and, you know, figuring out how I can be a better manager and a better owner and, you know, what are the best business practices. So I'm always still tinkering. I certainly do not feel like I have reached any kind of pinnacle.
How do you balance things out? And I mean, specifically being a mom, a wife, a CEO, business owner, athlete. And is there such a thing as balance?
You know, I mean, yeah, that's one of those words that's sometimes kind of annoying, actually, right? Because, you know, there are times when I don't have any balance, because if we have a big product launching or something new we're starting, you know, we had a shift in a management at our gym. And there was a night recently where I literally, Kelly was traveling. I was home literally like stirring a pot of soup with my right hand and emailing with my left hand. And telling my kids, like, I'm really sorry, you guys, but something urgent is happening I need to deal with. And you guys just need to do your own thing right now. You know, so I certainly have those moments. That's not how I operate on a day-to-day basis, but I certainly have moments where I don't have any balance. But I will say just the fact of having kids alone is sort of a balance creator. And I'm so grateful. I mean, in addition to the fact that I have Kelly and I have a total blast with our kids, they do just create a natural break. We talk about how we could easily work 18 hours a day if we didn't have kids. But we try to stay involved in their lives, and we do really try to honor having dinner together. So there's some basic things we always do. So, you know, that creates a natural break. I mean, you know, I have to leave the office because I have to pick up my kid at school. So, you know, for me, that's a really helpful natural break. And I'll say it's up and down for me. We have periods where we do a great job having balance, where we're not quite as busy, and other periods where we are probably a bit spastic and right. not the most balanced. So I don't know that anyone, you know, I guess my feeling is if anyone says they have perfect balance, I would be skeptical.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think there is such a thing as balance, to tell you the truth. What do you like to do for downtime? What kind of chills you out and relaxes you?
Well, I'll say this has been a work in progress for me because I'm not good at it. And, you know, I've tried yoga and meditation. One of the things that I've loved about the XPT training is that I'm a believer in and have tried endlessly to meditate, but it has not worked out for me because all I do while I'm meditating is A, think about the other things I should be doing, or B, sort of like, you know, getting mad at myself because I'm not thinking about what I'm supposed to be thinking about. And in the end, it becomes stressful and not relaxing. Yeah. So, but one of the things I've taken away from XPT that has been really helpful for me is this breathing practice that I've learned from Laird and Brian and Gabby. And what I like about it is it, because it's a sort of active, you know, you have sort of like, you know, one of the things we do is like 7 second breath in, 20 second breath hold, 14 second exhale. So there's sort of a thing that you're focused on. And so for me, it's really had a really meditative effect for me, and has been effective in part because it's a little bit more active than just traditional meditation. And so it's actually allowed my crazy brain to chill and focus on the breath and the timing and so forth. So that's been really helpful for me. I, like you, am a voracious reader. So I love to read. That's, you know, when I fantasize about retiring, my fantasy is that I'm going to sit in my crappy Walgreens lawn chair in Yosemite at a campsite and read books for like 3 months continuously. So, yeah. So that's sort of my own retirement fantasy, but I'm with you. I mean, reading is really a relaxing and sort of like regenerative thing for me. This breathing practice has been helpful. And then also play, you know, I think that's the thing we've really lost, in a lot of people have lost. We do, even though we have this crazy busy life, we really do try to play both on our own and with our kids.
Yep.
You know, we love to mountain bike. Every summer we take a, you know, 5-day wilderness river trip with our kids where it's completely technology free. And, you know, we're just active and we love to camp and ski. So, you know, playing, I think for me, is also a huge part of my, you know, sort of down regulation practice, so to speak.
Definitely. Yeah. I love to do the play with my kids all the time as well, especially on the off training days and things and days you just need to like kind of get away from things. I take my girls over to, we have a little park over here by the house, and we just go over and shoot hoops. It's the greatest time, just run around with those two. And then I've always been a swimmer. So, you know, whether it's ocean or pool, just get in there and just act like a goofball. It's fantastic.
Oh, it's the best.
Back to your breathing. Is this something that you do every day now?
Yes, I try to do it every day. I actually do it in the morning, which sounds strange because, you know, it is sort of a down regulatory practice, but I tend to just wake up and do about 10 minutes of it actually while I'm still laying in bed. I think ideally a 20 minute or 25 minute breath practice would probably be more optimal, but 10 minutes is sort of what I can fit in before I get up and make lunches and get kids ready for school and so forth. So that's sort of what I have time for. But I usually do it in the morning. I wake up, even if I have to set my alarm 10 minutes early, and just do 10 minutes of basic breathing. I've also, in addition to it feeling like a down-regulatory practice, it's actually been really helpful in my training. I realized when I started doing this breathing that I don't really think I was actually breathing ever in most of my training. You know, I really noticed it when I got on the rowing machine. I think I started doing the breathing about a year ago, and I would get on the rowing machine in the gym, and I realized that the way I had been breathing on the rowing machine was like, you know, I took all these really like shallow breaths, and for each stroke, I'd take like three shallow breaths, and I was never really getting full excursion in my lungs. And so it's had this, I started doing the breathing, so as part of a down-regulation meditation practice, but it's been interesting to see how it has affected my training. You know, obviously when you're, you know, in the Olympic lifts or some of the heavy lifts, breath is such a huge part of it, and the timing of the breath is so important. But I did realize that in my more metabolic conditioning type training, that I was just not really breathing and maybe never even taking a full breath in. So it's been really cool to use this both to downregulate and then to incorporate into my training. And I notice a huge difference actually in sort of the quality of my training and my endurance and some other, you know, just basic training things.
How do you monitor your health? And I, the reason I'm asking this is because I think somewhere in one of the interviews with Kelly, he seemed to kind of refer to you and some things that you were doing technology-wise. And
well, I am, first of all, I'll start by saying I am a fan of a no-technology, what I like to call readiness assessment.
Okay.
And I do it in the morning, and it's through a couple things. I mean, the first thing I ask myself is, it's literally a yes or no question. Did I get 7.5 hours of sleep minimum or more? And if the answer to that is no, I think really hard about whether or how I'm going to train that day. I also sort of do like a little mood, like what's my mood on a 1 to 10 basis. And then also the thing that Kelly and I have really been trying to tap into in the last 5 years is, what's my desire to train? You know, and we feel like we've really sort of figured out now without any technology, there are just these days where I just do not want to train. And I'm someone who loves training. It's what I like to do for fun. And I don't, you know, for me, it's not a difficult habit to have in my life. So I've really tried to learn to listen to that, like sort of inner voice, whatever, you know, whatever that is, that's saying, yeah, just not really up for it today. So sometimes that means, you know, even if I'm on a training program, like I've been doing this rowing program, and I'm actually like a week behind on the program, because there are some times when I can tell that I need to take 2 continuous days off from training. And I can tell that just literally by listening to my own body. The other thing that's been really interesting about the ice and heat practice and the breathing is when I do the 10 minutes of breathing in the morning, you know, usually what I do is I do an inhale for 7 seconds, breath hold for 20 seconds, exhale for 14 seconds. Or I modify it a little bit, but if I am burnt, I literally have trouble holding my breath for 20 seconds. And so that's a little cue to me, like, okay, maybe I need to think about how I'm going to train or whether I'm going to train today.
Right.
And then likewise in the ice, if I am totally blown out and I get in the ice, it hurts like 10 times worse.
Yeah.
Versus if I'm well recovered, I can actually get in the ice and manage the ice for a couple minutes. And, you know, I'm not going to say it's comfortable, but I'm not dying. So for me, those are sort of like my non-technological readiness assessments.
Yeah.
I do wear, well, I'll start by saying Kelly and I have literally tried every tracker and band and whatever. And most of them don't really work for me. I mean, to start with, I can barely keep my iPhone charged, let alone also have to charge like a Fuel Band or a FitAid, or not a FitAid, a Fitbit, or all these devices. So just the fact of having to charge it seems, at least to me, to add an extra step to my life that is sort of like, it's a draw and feels stressful. So I actually wear something called a Withings. It's a tracking device. I have no connection to them professionally at all. And I like it only because it has a 9-month battery life.
Uh-huh.
And all it tracks is my movement and my sleep. And so for me, those things have been interesting. And I will say that, you know, it's, what is it, like 80s technology, a step tracker? You know, you could get like a pedometer in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
But I do, what I find is helpful about that step slash movement tracker is it actually does change my behavior sometimes. You know, if I am working at home, for example, and I need to take something to FedEx and I look down, my step goal every day is like a minimum of 12,000. And if I look down and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I'm at 8,000,
yeah,
I choose to walk to the FedEx as opposed to drive my car. So it actually does sort of change my behavior a little bit. And in that way, I really like it. The sleep tracker was really interesting. It was actually introduced to me. The Withings was introduced to me by our friend Kyle Kingsbury, who's an MMA fighter.
How do you spell that?
Do you know Kyle?
No.
It's Withings, Withings. It's a French company. And you can get this thing on Amazon called the Withings Go for $80. That's another reason I like it.
Right.
And yeah. Kyle said he got it because he of course has a little baby, but he got it because he was like, I am laying in bed for 9 hours a night and I wake up and I feel terrible. And the sleep tracker did show him that, yeah, he was laying in bed for 9 hours a night, but on one night he showed me he'd woken up 17 times. That was sort of interesting and informative for him to figure out how he could optimize his sleep and stay asleep for longer, which is of course an entirely different conversation. But I like the Withings because I don't have to charge it. I wear it all the time. It tracks my sleep and movement. It does inform my, you know, it does inform my decision making a little bit in terms of how much movement, because as you know, when we talked about Stand Up Kids, Kelly and I are like downright obsessed with getting as much non-exercise physical activity in a day. So this helps me sort of keep myself honest on that. You know, we think heart rate variability is super cool and interesting and are believers in it, but we have yet to, and again, we've tried all the devices, we have yet to find one that fits into our busy life. You know, Kelly used one called an Omega Wave for a while, and we would have this funny interaction in the morning. I don't know if you've tried it. And it's cool, and the data is wonderful, but, you know, the way it works is you have to get up and then wait 15 minutes. And then you have to go into like a quiet place and attach all these things to your body and lay there. And so we would have this thing where I'd be like, Kelly, I need you to make the kids lunch. And, you know, or, oh my God, or like our daughters would go in and bother him or whatever. Somehow the way that our mornings work, it did not work for him to get up for 15 minutes and then go like try to lay down in a dark room and track his data. So that was a failed strategy for us. I think it might work well for other people, and I'm certainly a fan of that kind of data, but it totally does not work for us.
Yeah,
so we've basically gone low to no tech, and we really just have tried to sort of, you know, listen to the internal signs. You know, we, of course, like you, think sleep is king. So for me, you know, anything less than 7.5 hours, I really have to think hard about whether I'm even going to train at all.
Yeah,
because it might not be worth it.
So I love your questions, and I just want to ask a follow-up to that. When do you make the decisions on those questions? Is it as soon as you get up? Is it in the first 60 to 90 minutes? I'm trying to think of when is a fair assessment of that, because I know if you just get up and you ask those questions, at least for me, you know, I might look at the mood question and the desire to train. It might be low, but an hour later or later in the day, that might completely change. Yeah.
Yeah, I usually do that a little ways into the morning. So I'm one of those people that, you know, sleep so deeply that you could rob my house and I wouldn't notice. So I'm slow to get going in the morning. So usually our routine is we wake up, we do about 10 minutes of breathing, then we have coffee, get our kids ready for school, walk them to school. Which means we've already gotten like 6,000 steps or something by 8 o'clock in the morning. And then really quickly before we go to work, we do our little ice heat situation. So it's usually right after that. So I've already walked a 5K basically. Yeah. I've had coffee. I've done a little ice heat and a little breathing. And you know, it's like 8:15 in the morning.
Yeah.
Then I say, okay, how do I feel now? And that's kind of when I do my little no technology readiness assessment.
Okay, that's reasonable. Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Because if it for me was at 6 o'clock in the morning, right when I wake up, I would never exercise again.
Right. Because yeah. I'm like, that's what I was thinking. It might be tough to answer
those
questions.
I'm barely alive right then.
Right, right. All right. A couple more quick questions that we're going to wrap up. I don't want to keep you longer than I told you. So if you had to describe Kelly in a couple of words, what would you say?
He is really smart. He has an amazing knack for spotting patterns, which is part of the reason why he's so good at seeing and assessing and understanding and, you know, creating a whole system around movement and mechanics. He is super funny. You know, like one of the most fun things about being married to him is we just laugh and laugh all the time about random stuff. We never stop laughing. He is adventurous, and that's great because we love to, you know, try new things and go out in the world and be adventurous. And then he is just actually a really kind-hearted person. You know, he is generous and kind with his time and spirit. And, you know, I'm lucky to have a partner like him. He's totally awesome.
You guys are awesome. How would he describe you?
Jeez.
In a couple of words.
God, he might say like tigress or something.
Tigress? Okay.
He would probably describe me in terms of like my animal totem. Uh-huh. You know, I think he would probably say some similar things. I mean, he would probably say that I'm super organized and also generous and kind, probably. Yeah. But it's hard for me to say that. It's embarrassing.
Yeah. I'll have to ask him that question at some point. I know he would, that would be a really long-winded question, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But he, you know, I'll say that he is a really amazing human. And, you know, one of the things that's so fun is, you know, we have our gym, San Francisco CrossFit, and we do have quite a few visitors who come in, and people come in and like, oh my God, Kelly, you're here. And Kelly's like, well, yeah, I mean, like, I own this gym and this is where I go to work. And, you know, but I mean, he really does, you know, like it, with visitors to our gym and anyone who's interested in talking to him, you know, he is always open and welcoming and generous with his time and attention. And that's no different for me as his wife. And, you know, I just, it sounds cliche, but, you know, we really are great friends and like to do the same things. And we just have a total blast together.
Let me ask you, we talked a little bit about books, so I'm going to ask you one of my standard closing questions. What's the one book that you'd recommend to the audience?
Are you hoping for like a book in the business or health and fitness world?
Whatever comes to mind, whatever you think would be important.
All right. Yeah. Well, my single favorite book of all time is called King Leopold's Ghosts.
Wow. Never heard of that.
It's a little bit sort of out of topic because I bet you and I have very similar reading lists. I read a lot of business books. I love fiction as well. So, you know, I'm all over the, sorry about that. I don't know what that is.
No problem.
I'm all over the map in terms of my, you know, reading and so forth. But this book, for some reason, had the biggest impact on me. It's all about King Leopold from Belgium overtaking the Congo. Turns out that it was the largest genocide in human history that happened there, and most people don't know that. This sounds terrible and super depressing, this book, but I'll tell you that I have been telling Kelly since the day we met, I was like, King Leopold's Ghost is the greatest book I've ever read. And it actually took him until last year to read it.
Uh-huh.
And it's a thick book. It's like 1,000 pages long.
Oh, wow.
He read it in like 2 weeks, and he was like, oh my God, you were right.
Really?
The greatest book ever.
Oh my gosh.
So it's really fascinating. It's super well written. You know, it is sort of written in, even though it's nonfiction, it's written in a fictionalized way. It's super readable and it's truly fascinating. So that's probably not what you expected, but I hope if you read it, you and I can have a mini book club about it.
Well, I'm going to have to check that out. It's not something that I typically look at, but I love these uncommon books. So that's why I just leave it, whatever the person says that I asked that question, whatever book comes to mind, that's a book I'm going to look into. So awesome. Final question. What's a simple actionable takeaway for the audience after hearing our little session here today?
I think it would be the little readiness assessment I talked about. For me, it's been really helpful to focus in on what's working and not working, and, you know, ask myself some really simple questions on a daily basis and sort of plan my training and activity based on that.
I love it. Would you mind if I kind of wrote that up a little bit in the show notes?
Not at all. Episode, please
kind
do
of the questions, and that way people can look at it and refer to it. And I love it. So, Juliet, wow, this has been totally awesome. I'm so glad that we did this session and we got to learn a lot about you. Still a lot of questions I didn't get to, but I think we covered a lot in the time that we had. So, thank you so much.
It is so fun to talk to you, and you are crushing it. I love your podcast. I don't have time to listen to a ton of podcasts, but you just are such a wonderful interviewer and have so many great guests. So it's such a pleasure to be on.
Thank you. Hey guys, thanks for listening to the show this week. I hope you enjoyed this week's session. Make sure to go to ardellatraining.com/join to have some great free training resources sent your way right now. This is also the best way for you to stay up to date with the latest things coming from Ardella Training. Again, you can go to ardellatraining.com/join, and I hope to see you there. Thank you for listening this week, guys, and I've got a great special edition episode coming for you next week to celebrate 200 episodes here on the Ardella Training Podcast. Thanks, and I'll see you again next time. Take care.